You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Studio computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T-minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for 220K.
T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leto Sanic.
Control room, you're on here.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment we are speaking to well-known author Mr. John Armstrong. Hello John.
Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning. You sent me another video. You've done some more research. You're always discovering something. The thing I like about your research is you find things that nobody else has found. And even if some people say, well, they disagree about this, they disagree about that. Yes, but look at the things you have discovered. I always get a lot of compliments, people saying thanks for having John on because, you know, we don't hear this stuff. And this is information that only a few people have had the time to dive into. So, I guess you have a couple of things you want to bring up. I give you the floor right now.
Well, yeah, there's a couple of things that I think people in general have not focused on. And bringing a few of these things out might help people understand where I'm coming from, understand what happened, and so on. One of the things I find interesting is Earlene Roberts. She was the housekeeper at North Beckley, and she told the FBI that Oswald left the rooming house zipping up his dark-colored jacket. Now, this has been overlooked forever. What you need to do is, what people should do, is simply go back and look at Wesley Frazier's sister and her Warren Commission testimony, which, I mean, I think is crucial. She told the Warren Commission that when Oswald came up, she was standing at the kitchen window. She watched Oswald as he approached the house, walking from Ruth Payne's house to the Frazier's house to get a ride with Frazier to the book depository on Friday morning. She said he was wearing a dark colored jacket. Now, the Warren Commission knew that was a problem because they have Oswald wearing the light colored Eisenhower type jacket. So the Warren Commission showed her both jackets, Commission Exhibit 162, Commission Exhibit 163. And very clearly, she identifies the dark blue jacket as the one she saw Oswald wearing when Oswald was walking past her kitchen window to Wesley Frazier's car, which was in the little carport alongside the house. Now, that's interesting because you also have the taxi driver, William Whaley, describing Oswald's jacket and his dark brown shirt, the same blue jacket. So he comes to the rooming house. He leaves the rooming house zipping up his dark blue jacket, wearing a dark brown shirt. Now, that's at 102, 103. Now, in my view, from the documents, there's no question that Tippit was shot at 106. You people will have to read my analysis and my description of the Tippit murder to understand that. But 106 is exactly when Tippit was shot. But the man who shot Tippit was wearing, now this is 3 minutes. He leaves the rooming house at 102, 103. And 3 minutes later, somebody who I think was Lee Oswald, not Harvey, is wearing a light colored jacket and a white T-shirt, as described by the driver of the red Ford Falcon, the Ford Galaxy 500, Jack Tatum, and also described by Ted Calloway as Oswald was walking, hurrying south on from 10th and Patton as he rounded Virginia Davis's house. So in a 3-minute time period, you got Oswald, Harvey, leaving the rooming house wearing a dark colored jacket, zipping it up. And 3 minutes later, 9/10 of a mile away, you've got a guy wearing an Eisenhower type windbreaker jacket, light colored, with a t-shirt, shooting Tippit. That needs to be, I think, brought to the surface more and understood for what it is. It's two different people. So, you have any questions about that?
No, I don't have any questions. I know sometimes people are more comfortable saying Oswald impersonator. Impersonator. These impersonations seem to pop up everywhere. You know, your opinion is a little deeper. So, but...
Well, yeah, the impersonations keep popping up everywhere. I mean, my gosh, when do they stop? I mean, you've got impersonations of someone in the morning with Tippit, same time as the Top 10 Record Store when Oswald's over at Ruth Payne's house in Irving. 10 o'clock, Oswald shows up with a driver's license, shows a Texas driver's license to Fred Moore at the Jiffy store when Harvey's working at the book depository, moving boxes around on the sixth floor. Then you've got a man who was described by several people, one lady, as if it wasn't Oswald, it was his, you know, twin brother or something like that, getting into the Nash Rambler station wagon when Oswald's getting into McWhorter's bus. So, you know, you can go back and back and back and back, and you got Oswald's everywhere. John Hart Eli was one of the people who Warren Commission attorney. He was 26 years old, and he's almost very well, not very well known by the public. He was the youngest member, youngest staff attorney to work for the Warren Commission. But he, after the Warren Commission, a few years later, he was law professor at Yale. After that, he was law professor at Harvard, and then 14 years as the dean of the law school at Stanford, and recognized as one of the leading constitutional scholars of his generation. So the man was every bit an academic. And he started questioning Oswald's duplicity in 1964 when he was working with the Warren Commission. He could not understand. He talked to people at Santa Ana, California, who worked with Oswald in the radar section at Santa Ana. And he knew all of the names. He talked to these people by phone. He read their interviews and so on. Then he talked to a Sergeant Goodwin at El Toro. And this guy said he was good friends with Oswald. They went to the movies a lot. And he mentioned the names of people like Sawchuck, Hurd, other Marines that were at El Toro, which is about 7 miles away from Santa Ana. And he couldn't understand why he'd never heard these names before. And he couldn't understand what Oswald was doing at El Toro when he clearly was assigned living in a Quonset hut at Santa Ana. And then years later, he, in 1975, Eli wrote something that is, he wrote a summary of his feelings, if you will, about the Warren Commission. It's on the website. And basically what he said was, well, let me see if I can read it. This is well worth reading. Give me a minute here. Okay. He said, this was 1964 with the Warren Commission, not 1975. We were all more innocent a decade ago. Since that time, to our collective sorrow, we have learned many things. We have learned, contrary to what once seemed common sense, that persons in high places will, at substantial risk to themselves, cover up for the misdeeds of subordinates who seem of little consequence. We have learned that investigative agencies are not the monoliths we once thought they were, that schemes of substantial monument are planned and sometimes executed at relatively low levels, but they may be carried out by persons who are in no true sense members of those agencies, but rather independent contractors with an on-again, off-again sort of association, and even that people can be led to think they are working for such agencies when in every official sense they are not. In 1964, one had to be a genuine radical to take seriously the thought that other federal agencies were withholding significant information from the Warren Commission. In 1975, that would take a person of unusual naivety to ignore that possibility. And then he went on to say, hang on a minute, got to find it. It's very important what he said. Very, very important. I just have to find it. Then Mr. Eli wrote, devising a coherent and credible theory to explain what happened in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963, one that isn't forced to hypothesize a number of duplicate Lee Harvey Oswalds, has proved quite a different matter. So Mr. Eli, in his own words, knew that there was something related to more than one Oswald. Now, in April of 1964, Albert Jenner wrote to General Counsel J. Lee Rankin of the Warren Commission about Mr. Eli's conduct. By the way, Mr. Eli's job for the Warren Commission was to investigate the family history and background of Marguerite Oswald and Lee Harvey Oswald. So Eli was in the best position of anyone in the Warren Commission to run into all these duplications of Oswald, more than one Oswald. He found duplications, of course, in El Toro, Santa Ana. He couldn't understand Oswald in Japan when Oswald was in Taiwan. And so anyway, he's got all these notes, and Albert Jenner wrote to J. Lee Rankin, and here's what he said. Our depositions and examinations of records and other data disclose there are details in Mr. Eli's records which will require material alteration and, in some cases, omission. So I am very curious about the extent of Mr. Eli's knowledge related to duplicate Oswalds simply based on what he wrote in this one-page synopsis that's on the warrant, that's on my website, and also of Mr. Jenner saying what he did. We're going to have to omit certain areas of Oswald's background. So duplicate Oswalds, I'm not the only one that thinks there was a Harvey and Lee. I think Mr. Eli, through his own words, had similar suspicions. So the Mr. Eli thing was brought up only because you were wondering about Harvey at 1:02 p.m. And 3 minutes later, somebody who I think was Lee Oswald shooting Tippit at 10th and Patton. Anyway, the 10th and Patton thing is very, very misunderstood by people who I think just have not read the Dallas police transcripts at all. The Dallas police transcripts have a lot of information. It's been there for 60 years. And frankly, I don't understand why people haven't paid a lot of attention to this at all. For example, We all know about the Dudley Hughes ambulance that picked up Tippett's body and took it to Methodist Hospital. But very few people realized there were three ambulances dispatched by the Dallas police. It's right in the page 1920 of the Commission Exhibit 705, which is the Dallas police transcripts that were transcribed on the dictaphone and dictabelt machines, and then they were typewritten. You had three ambulances. Dallas police gave the code 602, number 602, to the Dudley Hughes ambulance. Code 603 was given to the Baylor ambulance from Baylor University. Code 605 was for the Veterans Administration ambulance. And they're right there on the Dallas police transcripts. And there's also a couple of codes that people have not interpreted. One is code 5 and one is code 6. Now, what you will see when you read the police transcripts, for example, is 602 code 5. All right, 602 is the Dudley Hughes ambulance. Code 5 means that the driver, the ambulance driver, the person making the recording to the Dallas police dispatcher, is en route to the site. The same dispatch came from the Dudley Hughes ambulance within, I don't know, half a minute later. 602 code 6. 602, again, is Dudley Hughes ambulance. Code 6 means he arrived on site. Now, the three ambulances, the significance of the three ambulances is the time recorded on the Dallas police transcript. Every one of these police ambulances, 602, 603, 605, code 5, they're en route at 1:10 p.m. Remember, the Warren Commission told us that Tippett was shot at 1:16. Yet you've got three ambulances en route to the scene at 1:10. You've got Jasper Clayton Butler, the ambulance driver for Dudley Hughes, code 6, on site at 1:10. And you've got Butler telling the dispatcher, "I think he's dead," at 1:10. You got Boley grabbing the microphone from Domingo Benavides, who is trying to use the microphone to contact the police dispatcher, but he didn't know how to use it. He pushed the button once, which recorded on the police dispatcher's note, recording on the dictaphone machines, 78, in other words, 78 contact. But he pushed the button a few seconds later, and there's a second contact, number 78. That occurred at 1:08 p.m. And then along comes Bowles, who grabs the microphone, and he's telling the police dispatcher, "There's been a shooting out here, 10th Street." That's at 1:10. Boley shows up, Jasper Butler shows up at 1:10. And he tells the police dispatcher, "I think he's dead." And then they took him to the Methodist Hospital. So the Dallas police dispatcher's dictabelt recordings, channel 1 and channel 2, there are two channels, recorded Boley's trying to contact the dispatcher at 1:08, two times. Now, why do I say Tippett was shot at 1:06? Domingo Benavides told the Warren Commission he was driving his yellow pickup, and he saw a police officer get out of the car. He saw a man wearing a white jacket pull a gun and shoot Tippett. He immediately pulled his truck into the curb and stopped, and he ducked down behind the dash. He didn't want to get shot. Well, he said he heard three shots. And he looked out and he saw Oswald as Oswald was starting to walk away. He saw Oswald from the front. And he refused to identify Harvey Oswald's photograph as the man who he saw from about 15 to 20 feet away. He was that close to Tippett's patrol car, 15 or 20 feet. And he saw Oswald from the front. He saw Oswald turn away and start walking away, ejecting shells from his gun. And he also said something that was very important, but not understood by most people. He said Oswald's hairline was squared off. All right, so what? Well, people need to read his testimony carefully. Benavides was a barber. That was one of the things he did. He was a barber. His little shop was in the Dudley Hughes building, the Eminence building. And when you see pictures of Oswald in press conferences at Dallas Police Headquarters, his hairline goes well down past his collar. But Benavides, a barber, noticed that he had a squared off haircut, which is something a barber, not, I wouldn't notice that, but a barber would. So you have three ambulances at 110 en route. Dudley Hughes shows up at 110. A couple minutes earlier, Benavides gets out of his car after Oswald disappears around the corner at 10th and Patton around Virginia Davis's house and starts walking south on Patton Street. Ted Calloway sees him, and then Warren Reynolds sees him, and he turns right on Jefferson Boulevard. Benavides gets out of his car, walks the police dispatcher, and he contacts the dispatcher by pressing the button on the police microphone two times. It's recorded at 108. So backing up, Tippett was shot a couple minutes earlier while Domingo Benavides was ducking down in his yellow pickup truck, 1:06 p.m. So that's the ambulances. Now, the essence of my latest essay on the Dallas police transcripts is very simple. You've got two main transcripts, and you got two very small transcripts. One is 2-page, one is 10-page. What happened was the Dallas police recorded all conversations from their patrol units on channel 1 and channel 2 with vinyl discs and vinyl belts, two different machines. And James Bowles, who was in charge of those dictabelt and disc machines, he made a typewritten transcript of the Tippett murder scene, basically between 12:30 and, what was it, 2 o'clock or something like that. And that is Commission Exhibit 705. It's a long, long transcript, 96 pages. And it contains about 4 pages on the Tippett murder. And the one thing that's critical about the police tapes and Commission Exhibit 705 is the times shown on Commission Exhibit 705. You see, the FBI had the transcripts and they had the Dallas police tapes, but neither the Dallas police or the FBI were really interested in the Tippett murder. They're interested only in Kennedy. How many shots were fired? Who said this? Who said that? And so on. So the Tippett murder was like a secondary thing to deal with. And in my opinion, the FBI didn't pay hardly any attention to the times on the transcript. It comes in March 1960. The Warren Commission, Rankin, writes a letter to the FBI and says, hey, there's a timing problem here. This transcript shows 1:10, but you FBI show the Tippit murder at 1:16. Could you please clear up this time discrepancy? That was in March. So the FBI creates their own transcript, which is Commission Exhibit 1974. And for some reason, researchers have never paid much attention to Commission Exhibit 705, the original Dallas police transcripts. They all look at the FBI report 1974. And you lay these two transcripts side by side, and you're going to be amazed. The FBI changed the timing on their revised transcript, which is 1974. All of the Dallas police ambulances that were called and showed up en route at 1:10. All those times, the Dudley Hughes, the Baylor, and the Veterans Administration ambulances timing of 1:10 when they originally called the Dallas Police Department was changed to 1:19. Benavides' contact with the Dallas police at 1:08 was changed. The number, the Dallas police transcripts show two contacts by unit number 78, which was the Dallas police Tippit's patrol car, number 78. The FBI changed one of those 78 numbers to 58 and another one to 488. And those are 58 is Dallas patrol car, and 488 is the Special Services Bureau. And then the FBI, under conversation, there was 78 to the right of 78 is a conversation that the Dallas police are having with the dispatchers having with the contact. Well, there was no contact made by Benavides. All he did was push the button, and there's the unit number 78 showing up on the police transcripts. The FBI called the conversations garbled. It's right on their transcript, Commission Exhibit 1974. And then they changed the times of the ambulances from 1:10 to 1:19. So they did that for a very simple reason. They knew that Oswald was at the rooming house at 102 or 103, according to Earlene Roberts. They had witnesses that said the shooting happened at 106, several witnesses. Boley gave the Dallas police an affidavit, said he looked at his watch when he got there. It was 1:10. Boley's conversation with the Dallas police at 1:10 was recorded on the Dallas police transcripts. And the Jasper Clayton Butler, the ambulance driver for Dudley Hughes, was recorded at 1:10. Well, there's no way that Oswald can walk from his rooming house at 102 or 103 and shoot Tippit at 106, 3 minutes. You can't walk 9/10 of a mile in 2 or 3 minutes. So the FBI realized in March of 1964, Oswald's dead. But the FBI has already said the Tippit shooting happened at 1:16. They've got to change the time. And that's the reason the timing was changed. But it's very important to realize that in March and April and May and June and July, that's 5 months. They held on to their revised transcript for all that time. Why? Because the Warren Commission was finishing up their investigation. And the FBI did not want to have to worry about Mr. Rankin looking at these times on the revised FBI report, Commission Exhibit 1974, and seeing the time of 1:19 with all these ambulances, Tippit shooting at 1:16, whereas the original Dallas police transcripts showed 110 and 108 called by Benavides. So the FBI had to stretch the time to allow Oswald enough time to have walked from the rooming house to 10th and Patton and shoot Tippett at 115 or 116. And that revised transcript was what everybody's been looking at for the last 60 years. And all you have to do, anybody can do it, lay them down side by side, look at the times. Now, the other thing that I want to bring up that, and I don't understand why this has not been a big deal, is a second wallet. That second wallet should have been, by researchers, years later, especially after reading Hostie's book in 1996, describing the second wallet. And by the way, the second wallet was filmed by Ron Ryland, and it appeared, Ron Ryland's film appeared on Dallas TV a day later, showing the second wallet at 10th and Patton. Now, you had all these Dallas police officers who heard Westbrook talk about the wallet at 10th and Patton. You had FBI agent Bob Barrett, who said, Westbrook asked him, do you know an Alex Heidel? Do you know a Harvey or a Lee Harvey Oswald? Ron Ryland filmed Sergeant Owens and Captain Talbert looking at the wallet. You had Croy that claimed to have found the wallet, and he gave the wallet to Captain Westbrook. And then Barrett said the last thing he saw of the wallet was Captain Westbrook with the wallet leaving the scene to go to the Texas Theater. So why all these people that testified before the Warren Commission, and there was Talbert, there was Owens, there was Sergeant Croy, there was Westbrook, all these people who testified before the Warren Commission, and they never mentioned the wallet? Not once? No written report about the wallet? That is a cover-up, a huge cover-up by the Dallas police. My feeling, right or wrong, is that Westbrook, he's got that wallet. Lots of people know he had that wallet, lots of police officers. What does he do with that wallet? I don't think Captain Westbrook can just make that wallet disappear. Too many people knew about it. I think what Westbrook did was, I think when he got back to the police station, he gave that wallet to Captain Pritz. And maybe, my opinion, for what it's worth, Pritz took one look at that wallet and said, my God, a second wallet at the Tippett murder scene? And I think that Pritz had real, real questions as to whether or not Oswald was even involved in the Tippett shooting. And I had wondered for years, 20 years, I wondered why Pritz never asked Oswald a single question about the Tippett murder. I couldn't figure that out. And then maybe it's because Pritz realized that Oswald did not shoot Tippett. He wasn't even at 10th and Patton. And if Pritz dared ask questions about the Tippett murder to Oswald, how did you walk there? What was your direction? You know, what were you wearing? I mean, all of those things. Oswald would have denied it. And Oswald would have denied that in front of other witnesses in Pritz's interrogation room, Secret Service people, FBI people, you know, Inspector Holmes, postal guy.
And maybe provided a viable alibi where as soon as they checked that out, he goes, oh, you were here. You were there, right? The whole story is going to fall apart before they get it together.
Well, let's think about that. Let's think about something people don't think about very much. Oswald leaves the rooming house wearing a dark colored jacket. When is the next time Harvey Oswald is seen? He's seen in the Texas Theater. Where's his blue jacket? What did he do with the blue jacket? The man that shot Tippit had a light colored jacket and a white t-shirt. That's what Jack Tatum said. That's what Ted Calloway said. All right, fine. But he's in the Texas Theater with a long sleeve, dark brown shirt and no blue jacket. Now, I won't get into this now. You can read it on my website. But a blue jacket was placed on Tippett's body after he was dead and laying in the street. And Jasper Clayton Butler, the ambulance driver, told the House Select Committee he removed a dark blue jacket from Tippett's body. And then he and Boley and the other guy with other ambulance helper, they loaded Tippett's body into the ambulance and rushed it to the Methodist Hospital. Tippett was taken out of the ambulance, brought into the emergency room. They tried to bring him back to life, and then he was pronounced dead by Dr. LaCoury at 1:15 p.m. So, the blue jacket and the brown shirt with the guy leaving Earlene Roberts' rooming house. 3 minutes later, a guy who people said was Oswald, wearing a white jacket and a white t-shirt, shoots Tippett. So, where's the blue jacket? What happened to it? Now, getting back to Fritz, Fritz said something that I think very few people know, and I didn't know until a few months ago. I found an article. I'm sorry, I don't have my computer on. I can't tell you exactly the person's name, but it's on the website. The whole article is on the website. Captain Fritz met with a reporter, and he tried to explain to the reporter, in my view, why he didn't question Oswald. And when I read this, I thought to myself, this guy is making up just an absolute nonsense story. So here's what he told the reporter. This is 1975. President Johnson already died. He tells the reporter, I received a call one day, and the secretary came in and said, somebody from the White House wants to talk to you. And Fritz said, I'm busy. A few minutes later, the lady comes back and says, the president is on the phone and he wants to talk to you. So Fritz says, my gosh, I got on the phone and President Johnson tells me, we've got our man. You've got our man. We're going to take it from here. The FBI, we're going to take it from here. Fritz said, okay. And then he turns to the reporter and he says, what could I do? The president told me it's out of my hands. Now, in my view, I think Fritz was just, he knew what happened, I think. He certainly knew about the second wallet, and he had to be part of the cover-up of the second wallet. All those police officers, all those detectives, all the captains, Captain Talbert, Captain Westbrook, they all had to be told not to say anything about the second wallet. Imagine if the press would have found out about a second wallet and ID cards for Alec Heidel. I mean, that would have thrown the whole thing upside down. So then the next thing I had to think about was Fritz's notes, his alleged handwritten notes that weren't found until, what, 30 years later? The ARRB, somebody anonymously gave those to the Association of Records Review Board. How can we believe anything in those notes, knowing the background of Fritz and the cover-up of the second wallet? So those are the things I think that need to be answered or at least focused on. The big cover-up of the second wallet and two people using very different clothing. One guy appears at the Texas Theater. One guy shooting Tippett at the same time. Remember, it was Butch Burroughs who said that Oswald showed up at the theater at 107, between 101 and 107. No blue jacket, just the dark brown shirt. And Butch Burroughs said he sold Oswald popcorn about 1:15. So Oswald is clearly in the Texas Theater when, in my view, Lee Oswald is shooting Tippett. Now, people ask, why would Lee Oswald go to the Texas Theater? That's crazy. Well, it might be crazy. But a lot of people, including me, think that the gun that the police took from Oswald was the gun that actually was used to kill Tippett. And it was Lee Oswald who brought that gun to the Texas Theater and handed it off to someone who handed it off to Harvey Oswald. Can't prove it, but I think that's a likely possibility.
All right. Now, you have a couple of new videos. I'm going to make links to that where you talk about this and you provide photos and some video footage. It's kind of like a slideshow, but it really helps with your narration in that. So I'll make a link to that. But it's interesting talking to you. There's always something new. It's just thanks for continuing the research.
Well, you know, you get into this thing and one thing leads to another, and you start putting pieces together. And it's remarkable how much has been overlooked. To me, it's remarkable how much has been overlooked. Three ambulances instead of one. Researchers, how many researchers have taken a stopwatch and timed how long it took Oswald to walk from the rooming house to 10th and Patton? I mean, that's a total waste of time. And people relying on FBI evidence after seeing what I've seen them doing by changing the time. Oh, I'm sorry. There's one other thing that I didn't fully expand on. The FBI, in my opinion, held on to the revised transcript as long as they could, as long as they possibly could. They did not want to chance Rankin or anyone else questioning their changing in time to 119 from 110 on the Dallas police transcripts. So what they did is they waited until August 25. This is very important. The Warren Commission did not get the revised Commission Exhibit 1974, the FBI's revised transcript with the revised timeline, until August 25th. Why? Because the government printing office at that time was in the process of printing the Warren report. And that Warren report, the final copy, the first copy, supposedly, was given to President Johnson a month later on September 24. So that's why the FBI held on to that, their revised transcript from March until August 24, was they didn't want to have anybody question their time, their revised times in their transcript.
You know, when I think about this and the FBI lying back then, when I just at arm's length looked into this, the latest assassination against Donald Trump, and you go, wow, this guy got up onto the roof and he's not a very good shot. And then, you know, it's only due to the fluke that Donald turned his head. I mean, bullets went by his ears, otherwise he'd be shot. And then you look at the FBI statements and the head of the Secret Service. It's just, it's pathetic. And I guess they just hope nobody reads the stuff.
Well, it's been going on since, for me, the first, look, when I got into this, I grew up as a kid seeing FBI Elliot Ness on TV, and the FBI is great and wonderful and so on. And it's no different than John Hart Eli said, the commission attorney, John Hart Eli said, 1964, we thought these agencies were monoliths. We thought they could do no wrong. And then 10 years later, he says, how anybody could trust these government agencies in 1975, we've learned you can't trust them. So it took me longer than that to come to the realization that something was wrong. And, you know, I remember my good friend, an attorney, we were very good friends. We were going up to his office in the elevator one time, and he said, "How's your book coming?" And I said, "Well, a couple of things I don't understand." I said, "I've got this document here. It says the FBI made this investigation, but the years are off. I mean, they were supposed to investigate where Oswald was in 1957 and 58, but what they did is they investigated this hotel, supposedly where Oswald, the Hotel Senator, where Oswald was and his mother were staying in 1954 and 55. I mean, they weren't there in 54 and 55. They were there in 57 and 58. So, I mean, it looks like they're just, he laughed at me. And he said, "Don't you understand?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean? It's the FBI's job to put people in jail." "Oh, it's up to defense attorneys like me to find out where they made their errors." So that started me on the path of not really questioning what was going on. And then one of the major discoveries that I made was in the National Archives. And I had Commission Exhibit 2003, which is the FBI's and the Dallas Police's inventory of Oswald's possessions. And they photographed each possession and they listed it on Commission Exhibit 2003. 455 items of evidence. Okay, fine. And then I thought, okay, where'd these items come from? Well, it came from the rooming house and it came from Ruth Payne's. And then I looked at the Dallas police reports and I'm confused because the Dallas police located, initial dated 225 items and they made handwritten and typed transcripts of the inventory. So the FBI gives their possessions, Oswald's possessions, to the FBI on November 26th, the evening of November 26th. They're all flown to FBI headquarters. And when it comes back, they do a joint FBI Dallas police inventory, and there's 455 items. Oh, my God. Wait a minute. The Dallas police send the FBI 225 items and the FBI sends back 455 items. What is going on here? So I went to the National Archives and it took me 2 weeks and I got 15 or 20 items a day, 30 items a day, whatever. And what I did is I looked for Dallas police initials on the inventory. And if the Dallas police initials were on the inventory, then I went to Dallas police reports and I put a check mark by them. Okay, that's here, that's here. When they did not have Dallas police initials, but they were listed on the Dallas police inventory of Dallas police gave the inventory on November 22nd. I'm sorry, I was wrong. November 22nd, gave the FBI 225 items. 3 days later, November 26th, that's when the FBI and Dallas police made their inventory of 455 items. So as I'm looking through these items, and if I find a few items that are not initialed by Dallas police, not dated, then I find them on the Dallas police FBI joint inventory, the 455, and I, make a mark. So it's very easy to find out which items were the original items found in the Dallas police and which items were added by the FBI. Now, a friend of mine went to the National Archives a few years ago and was going to try to do the same thing that I did. Well, the National Archives, in their infinite wisdom, is no longer letting people see any original items. If you want to see the original items of evidence, they'll bring out photographs.
Yeah, not much transparency there. They don't want people finding out.
No. And what that... Look, the FBI supposedly turned over their microfilm from Klein's to the National Archives. And, you know, I'm curious. I wanted to see the original microfilm. What do I find? They bring me a photograph of an empty Kodak box, a little yellow Kodak box. The National Archives, you know, I used to have a fair amount of trust in the National Archives. But after experiencing a few of these things, I think these agencies can just go in there and get whatever they want out or add whatever they want. I don't have much faith in the National Archives.
Right. And if they had this lone gunman evidence sewn up, they would be waving it like a flag. They'd be showing every, see, it all fits. Here's this, here's that, right? But they don't. And so 60, you know, 1 year later, they're still hiding.
Well, I think it goes beyond that. It's almost like the government against the people. The government is going to protect anyone who works for the government. You don't see any not many politicians going to jail or getting indicted or, you know, arrested, whatever. But when the public does the same thing that some of these politicians are doing, man, they throw the book at them. So, you know, it's a very one-sided
I feel your frustration. And
I was just going to say it's very frustrating, and you took the word right out of my mouth. Yeah, it is. It really is. There's so many things in the Kennedy assassination thing that should be brought to the surface, but are not, because they're not the magic bullet. They're not the rifle. There are other things that help to disguise all the little things that, if they were added up together, you know, you'd see a huge, the second wallet, that's a perfect example. I mean, if you just think about that for a minute, what would have happened if the second wallet would have been public information back in 1964? What if it would have been public information that Oswald left the rooming house wearing a blue jacket and he didn't show up at detectives? Why has nobody asked that question? Why has nobody said, all these good researchers, and there's a lot of good researchers, but why hasn't anyone asked the question, okay, Oswald left the rooming house at 101 or 102, and he arrives at the Texas Theater with no blue jacket. Where's the blue jacket? I mean, why haven't people asked that question? Why haven't people asked the question, blue jacket, brown shirt? But the Tippit shooting, white jacket, white shirt. I mean,
well, what I appreciate is your diligence in looking into anomalies here and digging up and reading things that no one else has read. I don't really blame other people. It's almost an information overload that you're interested in the assassination. And then you say, well, okay, who was this Lee Oswald character? And then you start to get, what do you mean there was these imposters? What do I mean there could be a double? You know, I mean, it just goes on and on. So for you to mention that, well, there's a lot of good researchers, but they haven't discovered this and that. I only say, you know, you've done a real credit to digging up these things that people have just overlooked for now. And then, you know, guys, you know, like, oh, I'll just pick up Mark Lane, you know, or Jim Garrison or Fletcher Prouty or everyone, Mae Brussel, people who have contributed, and then we all pool together. And it's a luxury now that we have the internet and websites. And I'll make a link to your harveyandlee.net that people can find out, well, what's this guy found and what's John found? Right. And, you know, what were in the Garrison files, you know, and but.
Well, Lynn, look, I started this thing in 1991 or what, 1990. I just attended a class with Jack White and Jim Mars at the University of North Texas. And I walked in there knowing nothing. A few interesting people came to that meeting. Madeline Brown, you know, Johnson's ex-girlfriend or whatever, she was there almost every meeting. She brought her son, who was the spitting image of Lyndon Johnson. and it was interesting, but you had to, you just have to crawl through all of this stuff to begin to understand it. I mean, you hear all of these people giving all of these talks and all this stuff, and you don't understand how these things link together until you just, you know, are into it for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And the links then slowly start to come together. And one link leads to another link leads to another link. For example, I'm not trying to extend this conversation, but for example, I knew that there was a Harvey and there was a Lee. You can look at North Dakota when Oswald's 1953, when Oswald's, what is he, 14 years old, 13 years old. Oswald's going to school in New York. He's in North Dakota. you've got Oswald Stripling, junior high school, when Oswald's at Beauregard, same time, 1954. These kids have got to have mothers. But that really didn't affect me, or I didn't think about that for years. Maybe 7, 6, 7, 8 years. Yeah, they're young, but okay. Anyway, so the only photographs that I ever saw, the only photographs that most people saw, was of the woman, the Warren Commission, Marguerite Oswald. So I started talking to people, trying to do a history on Marguerite Oswald. And I just so happened to Paul's Shoe Store. I went to the city directory in Fort Worth, Paul's Shoe Store. I saw the name of a couple of employees. And I just called the Fort Worth, you know, direct, looked in the Fort Worth directory. And in about 1997 or 98, I don't remember the name, I called one of the guys and he said, yeah, I used to work at Paul's Shoe Store. And it's like, oh my gosh, I can't yet. It's hard for me to believe, you know, 40 years later. And then he happened to tell me, Marguerite was his wife's Avon representative. She bought Avon products from Margaret. Well, now, wait a minute. That's not anything I ever heard before. I never heard of Marguerite Oswald selling Avon products. He says, no, that was one of the things she did. She worked in clothing stores. Worked in clothing stores. Uh-huh. Okay. He says, matter of fact, I've even got a picture, a group photograph of all of us that was taken in 1957. Lynn, I about fell out of my chair. You got a photograph of Marguerite Oswald in 1957? Oh, my God. I jumped in my car. I drove straight to Fort Worth. And I spent several hours with that guy. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name now. And he gave me his original 8x10 black and white photograph. And I took one look at that woman. And I thought, that is Lee Oswald's mother. She looks absolutely nothing like the Marguerite Oswald, you know, we have come to believe was the real Marguerite Oswald. And then you start reading things about people who knew Marguerite, who knew her for 20 years, Myrtle and Julian Evans, for example. They rented 1454 St. Mary's Street to Marguerite when she moved back from New York. And she and Lee lived there for almost a year. Almost a year. Interesting. And then both of those people said, when we saw Marguerite after all this happened, the assassination, we couldn't believe it was her. We could not believe it was her. She's changed so much. She used to be a beautiful, elegant woman. And to see what's come over her, why, we never would have known that was Marguerite Oswald unless somebody would have pointed it out and said, that's Marguerite. And I thought that was a very interesting thing because they just saw Marguerite 5 years earlier when they visited her in Dallas. And in 5 years, she changed that much. And then after I got to know Oswald's homeroom teacher in the eighth grade, Myra Drews, she talked about, now this is in 1954, it's very critical, but you got to put the times together. In 1954, when Lee and his mother were living at 1454 St. Mary's, at the same time, Harvey is attending Beauregard in the eighth grade in Myra Drews' homeroom class. So Robert Groden and I, we visited with his homeroom teacher, Myra Drews, videotaped her, and she talked about some kids who were playing in the basement cafeteria, where that's her home, where her homeroom was. And Ed Vogel comes running out and says, a piano fell on Harvey. So Myra says, I went back in the well, we all lifted the piano off of Harvey Oswald's legs. And then I took him to the Montelepre Clinic. After that, I took him home. Where did you take him home? Well, I took him to that terrible place. It was Exchange Alley, like an old alley. And he lived in this old small apartment. I said, you took, when was that? She said, February or March. It was when we were doing archery. February or March, Lee's living and his mother are living on 1454 St. Mary Street with Marguerite's friend of 20 years. And Myra says she took Harvey to his room on Exchange Alley. So when you see those things and you see a different photograph of two different women, then things start to come together. And these duplicate things about Oswald being in Japan in 1957 and 58, while at the same time he's working at the Pfister Dental Laboratory in New Orleans, that becomes real. When you see the North Dakota thing, it becomes real. And it's I don't want to get into...
Yeah, it's almost information overload for me right now, because I'm just trying to digest the first hour.
It's impossible. It's impossible to digest all of this stuff until you put the links together. It's all these little links together.
All right. Well, you have a website where people can find that out. You have a new video that I wanted to have you on. I know you phoned me from time to time, and I said, we should be recording these talks. So I'm glad you did today. I'm glad we talked, and researchers will be happy to hear your point of view. And whether they subscribe to everything or not, but at least I hope people learn, you know, those transcripts and how they were changed in the FBI, changing things even back then, you know. It's like
a signature, a
footprint of the crime.
Look, if you crack open the door, all right, and you see that the FBI changed the timing on the Dallas police transcripts, then you look at the FBI creating W-2 forms for Oswald's employment in 1956 when he's supposed to be in Japan in 1957, working at Pfister. You see all kinds of things like this. Then you wonder how much of this FBI, these interviews and things, are true. How much evidence they really had that, you know, was used to convict Oswald, and how much of it was fake. And like you said, you go to the, I don't care if it's people question 9/11, people question, you know, the Reagan shooting, you can question anything. But you have to get back to the possibility that this information is being fabricated, starting with the Kennedy assassination.
All right, Mr. Armstrong, thank you so much for your time. And if you have any other links, but I'll try to make in the show notes the appropriate links for things that we talked about.
You do that. Thank you very much. You have a good day.
You're very welcome. Good night.